Hey everyone, Adam D. from Indefensive Ska here. A little note before we start the show. Los Angeles is dealing with multiple catastrophic fires. A lot of people have lost their homes and are in need. If you're able to help, please do so. There are a lot of great organizations you can donate to, like California Fire Foundation, Pasadena Humane Society, Mutual Aid LA, and there's even a list of people in the music industry that have lost their homes. Links are in the show notes for our Rob Harvilla episode. Thanks.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to Indefensive Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book Indefensive Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Dancehall Crashers were formed in 1989 by Tim Armstrong and Matt Freeman. They were one of a handful of bands they formed after Operation Ivy disbanded, before they finally settled on Rancid. They weren't in Dancehall Crashers long, but the group continued on, eventually with lead singers Elise Rogers and Karina Deneke. Today we talked to Karina about Dancehall Crashers, how the group evolved in the early 90s, and eventually reformed in the mid-90s, scoring a record deal with MCA subsidiary 510 Records, and later MCA directly. We also talk about her time at NoFX, and see if a Dancehall Crashers reunion is in the cards. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
I never got to see Dancehall Crashers back in the day. Did you see them?
Yeah, I don't remember how many times I saw them, but I do have a pretty clear memory of seeing them at the Edge in Palo Alto.
Nice.
And I liked them. And I, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed, Karina and Elise were co-equal lead singers, which I don't feel like you see a lot of that in bands.
Yeah. Shout out to Crack, the band from San Jose that we used to go see. They had co-singers.
Yeah. I also remember that it felt like the way Karina and Elise presented themselves on stage was kind of a vibe of the way like hip hop groups do. Like the kind of like one person steps up and takes the mic, the other one kind of pulls back and they kind of trade off. Mm-hmm. I dig it. More bands, let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's do more co-lead singer type of situations.
And so, I mean, I think both of us discovered a lot of music back in the day through compilations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, definitely Dancehall Crashers I discovered from the California Ska Quake compilation, which was a really good compilation. If you're ever in the mood of like digging through, finding like the good ska comps from the 90s, that was a strong one. I think I even discovered Hepcat on that too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I think Skank and Pickle was on there too, but I did not discover Skank and Pickle from that compilation. I already knew Skank and Pickle.
And then if you want to go back, listener, our episode that we did at Mosswood Meltdown, we were lobbying really hard for a Dancehall Crashers reunion and saying that they would be a good fit on that bill if you want to go back and listen to that.
Yes, I mean, come on. Classic East Bay ska punk band. Perfect.
Yeah. Dancehall Crashers were a fun, infectious 90s East Bay ska band. And like we stated before, would be a perfect ska band to headline Mosswood Meltdown.
All right. Well, I think a good place to start since it just happened, at least at the time of this recording, is the NoFX shows. We just wrapped the NoFX shows. This was like last weekend, right?
Yeah. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday were our shows. Yeah. So it's been a week.
And it was kind of like this long final NoFX tour, kind of a long goodbye too.
Oh yeah. It's been a year and a half build up. Essentially, I mean, it was started to get scheduled 2 years ago. It was always the plan to have October 4th, 5th, and 6th in Los Angeles be our last shows. So we've been sort of like, you know, planning the tours and then doing the tour, which has been worldwide tour. It's epic. For the last year and a half. And the finals were last weekend, and it was really crazy and really intense, really beautiful. I think just so many people coming out to see the final three nights, like so many old friends, so many amazing bands like Tim Armstrong and like The Interrupters and Sum 41 and Brett Gurewitz and, you know, other, you know, Jay from Bad Religion and Greg Hedson and just like the list is like endless of like people kind of coming out and paying tribute and being so sweet. It was really emotional.
Was there any particularly special moments that happened over the last weekend that stick out, or is it all kind of just a blur?
I mean, there's definitely like a few things, you know, like the DOC, he's pretty awesome. He's there. To me, a big one was actually Tim Armstrong coming out, because, you know, Tim Armstrong started Dancehall Crashers, and I haven't seen him in a long time because just our paths don't cross that much generally, but you know, still good buddies and stuff, but I just don't like actually see him. And then, but I was playing Radio on keyboards. Nice. So he came out and sang that. So it was like kind of a weird, like, full circle thing where, you know, I'm like, he started Dancehall Crashers, and you know, and before he even started Dancehall Crashers, you know, we're from East Bay, Berkeley, and Gilman scene. So I would always see him around anyway before even Dancehall Crashers started. So I have that history and that background with him and Jesse Michaels as well. But more so with Tim, and which, you know, we used to call him Lint. So I still have to be like, Tim Armstrong. I have to like make that like, slow down, Karina, say his actual name. But so that was kind of a big full circle moment. There were a lot of those actually, but that one was a big one. Like, I'm playing keyboards on radio, and he came out and sang with Mike, and you know, East Bay and Gilmazine and Dancehall Crashers and Op Ivy and Rancid after that, and then me now playing with NoFX and now doing a cover of this. That was pretty like, that moment was pretty big for me.
Yeah, it was cool. I watched the footage of that one. That was definitely a highlight of just of the random clips that I would just see on social media. That was definitely a highlight.
Yep, that was a big one. Playing the Tony Sly song that Mike wrote with his daughters there and his wife Bridget, who I'm very very good friends with her and his girls and. So, and Darla, which is Mike's daughter, Aaron and Mike's daughter, you know, we're all good friends, and the girls, the young girls are all good friends, and to have them there, which they have been at shows before. So it's not like, but to have them there and be like, sort of like hugging on each other and crying and like have Mike just come up and, you know, give them a big hug afterwards. And I have to play piano on that. And I just got really nervous. Actually, which I don't normally get nervous, but it was just like, there was so much emotion and so much kind of just intense, like, you know, intense vibe. And the fact that they had asked Mike, like, can you play it now? Like sooner than the end of the set. And so that we just kind of did it last, like, okay, let's change the set. Let's do it now. And just having them there and like watching me and play the keyboard part, trying not to get emotional about Tony and, you know, being emotional about seeing them get emotional and like trying to keep it together. So those are maybe two of the big ones, you know.
At some point earlier in the year, I think it was in July, believe you were on tour with NoFX. There's this video clip of you and Chris Grau and John Graber doing a rendition of Dance With Me. by Hepcat.
Yeah.
Which I believe probably came as a tribute after Greg had passed, right?
Yes, it came as a tribute. You know, I feel a bit silly trying to even, you know, do that song, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But we were, I mean, meaning silly, like I can't do it like they would do it and we can't do
sure,
it.
Sure. Yeah.
They would do it. And so, but we were, you know, Greg Lee's a very close friend of mine and all the Hepcat guys are very close friends of mine. And I just adore them and they're really my favorite ska band of all time, you know? So fans and friends. And then after he passed, you know, I'm actually going to sing at his tribute this next weekend, October 20th.
Yeah.
At the El Rey. And yeah, so John Graber and Chris Grau, they'd flown in to cover for Hefe. I don't know if you know all that stuff, but that was like a whole thing. So, which I can explain, but Hefe had to fly back to, you know, do a film with Al Pacino and Vince Vaughn.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was mid-European tour, and he got this great offer, and it was sort of like, what are we going to do? We've got these shows planned, and you know, we were just, you know, the band NOFX just gave him his blessing, like, of course, what are you going to do? Say no to Al Pacino? No, you don't say no to Al Pacino, right? I mean, this is an amazing opportunity, and we had two shows that we had to cover for Hefe. So Graber learned all the guitar parts, Chris Grau learned some trumpet stuff and came in for that. And I sang Eat the Meek, and I was going to even sing like Radio and a couple of other like of the reggae tunes that he does. But so all three of us were there. And then I was like, let's just do like something. And it wasn't necessarily going to be that song. We just were like, what's something that we all know? And like, let's do something fun. Like, let's just record something backstage, like a little ska thing. Cause we're all into ska and, you know, these guys are punk rockers. They're not as into it. So it was going to be something silly and fun. And then it was like, well, we should maybe do this song. Yeah. And it was something we all knew. So yeah. And then it, of course, yeah. Ended up being, of course, that tribute to him because we love him very much. And I'm pretty devastated that he's not here. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very devastating. I didn't know him as well, but you know, I did know him a little bit and it was a very difficult thing to, you know, it was very difficult news to hear.
Yeah. It was such a shock. You know, he was a very physically fit and strong person. So it was a very unexpected.
Yeah, it was just random, really. I mean, sometimes that happens, just no rhyme or reason to it.
Exactly.
It's almost makes it more difficult when it's just like you can't put anything on it. You can't put any like explanation on it.
Exactly. It was pretty terrifying.
This episode will air after the Greg Lee Memorial has already happened, but since it hasn't happened yet, just kind of contextualizing it, like there's quite a few people who are involved in this. I think it really speaks to how much the scene like loved and loves Greg.
Yeah. He's kind of, in my opinion, like one of the epitomes of like the perfect front person.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible songwriting, incredible taste. Musically and, you know, fashionably as well. An advocator and a sort of champion of the scene, really a positive vibe, and like just their stage show, him and Alex together, and what he brought when he did it sometimes without Alex, when Alex was busy doing movies and things like that, and he had to do a solo thing. He just made everybody in the audience feel welcome, feel engaged, you know, bringing the fun, like let's dance, let's enjoy this special moment. And for me, I mean, I have a group of friends that we've all been always going to Hepcat shows for so many years. And it's always this huge deal for me. Like every time I go to one of their shows, I felt like completely inspired, you know, and lifted, you know, just being just such an adoring fan of them and feeling just elevated. And he was really amazing to be able to do that, because I don't feel that way with him. There's no way. And it's genuine, you know, it was genuine with him. I think that's the thing. I think if you're a performer yourself and you know what goes into having to put a show together, and have to create that sort of feeling with your audience, with your band members. Sometimes you just kind of don't feel good and want to stay home and watch a movie, and you got to put a show on, you know, like that. That's real. It's just like going to work. You're not always in the mood to do that thing. And so you have to kind of amp yourself up into it and, you know, remember why you love doing it and all the things if you're not in the right space. And so to me, he was just magnificent at that. And I know that most people feel that way that saw them and saw him and think that they were really like champions and amazing at creating, you know, this very LA sound, but bringing in the old time ska stuff, which a lot of other bands obviously weren't doing. We kind of, you know, many of us kind of switched into kind of a punky ska kind of, you know, 90s sound. And to me, I always love the trad stuff anyway. That's what I grew up on and I love. And they did it so well in creating something new with it, you know, throwing in cha-cha and Cuban music and, you know, a little salsa and just like having such a mixture of a good LA vibe with, you know, everybody. I mean, they have like Filipinos in the band, they have like Latinos in the band. Like it's, they kind of create this real LA sound to me as an English girl growing up that I just references trad ska, of course, very well, but nobody else does it like them.
I really like too, how Greg, so they would, you know, Greg was very much an advocate for saying like, you know, you should dance to ska music and he would, him and Alex would demonstrate it, encourage people to dance, not just kind of like lose their minds. Right. Yeah. But he did it in a way where it wasn't like, he was inclusive. He wasn't really putting down like the punk ska stuff. It was more just like, hey, why don't you try this and kind of join us in this effort to like actually dance and move our bodies in a more like conscious way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the you know, scenes can get, especially, you know, I grew up in the skinhead scene a little bit and the punk scene, people can be weird and not always, just to remember to be playful and to remember to have like a lot of love there. And he was able to cross over, you know, a lot of people from the skinhead scene or the punk scene or the reggae scene or the ska scene, like they loved them. And he was very good at like being inclusive with everybody. So yeah, it's just a huge loss. It was such a shock. I was in Japan when I heard the news and I was getting messages from friends like, just on my like Facebook Insta message thing. And I was like, what's going on? What's going on? Like, have you heard the news about Greg? I was like, no, what's going on? And it was just so horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So back to NoFX. So you officially joined NoFX in 2015. Is that the case?
2016. Mm-hmm.
So at this time that you're joining NoFX, so I don't know if it relates or connects to it, but you released your debut solo album like in 2015. I don't know if there's any connection mm-hmm. to that. No, it's just, okay. But the main thing though is that you were working on the Home Street Home with Fat Mike. That definitely led to it, right?
Well, you know, Dancehall Crashers toured with NoFX many times in the 90s. You know, we're on Fat Records. I'm very close friends with everybody at Fat. I sang on multiple tracks of NoFX stuff like I'm an Alcoholic and Mattersville, like, you know, on War and Irism and Coaster. So like for many years, I've been part of like an the Fat Records, like I'm the girl singer for like, you know, No Use for Name and Tony Sly. I sang on like tons of his solo material as well as No Use for Name. And I sang on High Standard track and I sang on Limp track and I sang on like, so I was kind of like the call girl for that, you know, like, so, and hung out with those guys a lot, there was a big Fat Records scene that we used to hang out and go to all the shows and party together all the time. Mm-hmm. So we were close friends. But then, yes, I started working with Mike on Home Street Home a bunch because he had his Motor Studios in the city and he would call me and just be like, I want you to come and try these vocals out. So I was workshopping his female characters with him. And that was like several years of that where I would be like, you know, he's like, okay, can you sing it? Like, I can't figure out if I want this character to be this way or this way. Can you sing like, you know, that? And you're like, that's kind of how Mike sings, right? It was a really bad impersonation of him, but something like that, a little bit more like that. And, you know, me just trying to determine, like, do you mean da 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 da? You know, I'm going like, yeah, yeah, but they change the third note to like, you know, and you're like, so like working with him, trying to figure out what he actually was trying to sing to you. But then, so that's kind of, you know, I could kind of sort that out with him, which was funny. And, you know, makes me a good collaborator with him in that way, because not everybody can work, can understand what that means. But also, yeah, he would just be like, I want this girl character to be from Brooklyn, like try a Brooklyn accent, and now try her as a whiny teenager, and now try her as, you know, an English with an English accent, because I grew up in England. So like, give her a Cockney accent, give her this. So he would kind of like play with these variations on these characters. So it was myself, Stacey D was me and Stacey D, and Billy Bouchard, who was in a band called Water Dog many years ago, and also in Limp, and another band called The Affection. He was in Sam I Am for a long time too. It's a great songwriter and singer. So the three of us were doing a lot of that, and Spike as well was kind of coming in. But because I was workshopping with him a lot, and things were changing constantly, like, and then I would come in and play vibraphone because I have a vibraphone, and then I would kind of work some keyboard stuff out with him, like, well, do you want this chord here, or do you want like a 7 chord? And he's like, what is that? It's a jazzy chord. I'm like, well, it's not really that jazz, but okay. Yeah, so like, you know, we were doing a lot of that, so he knew I played a little bit of keyboard, and then I would also help him get a lot of musicians in town, because I play with a lot of people in the city. So he'd be like, you know, I need a harpist tomorrow, or I need a cellist, you know, today, or I need, you know, 2 trumpet players and a French horn, you know, like super random stuff. And I was like able to kind of help him a lot of the times, like, hey, let me get, you know, this person can do it tomorrow. Can we do it tomorrow instead of today, Mike? Cause it's a little bit last minute, you know, it's like, you know, so workshopping all that work, Home Street Home stuff. And then other people ended up re-recording most of our parts, like me and Stacey and Billy and Spike. Like the actors that were, they were trying to get to do the actual performances, and things changed so many times, but at a certain point they were re-recorded. But in the meantime, yes, it meant that Mike and I were working together a lot and just having fun in the studio, and he knows how I work and I know how he works, and I can deal with all his funny way of communicating. He's pretty direct. He's not very like, I mean, when he loves it, he'll be like, yes, 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 that's it, you know, get really into it. But he's also like, no, no, not that note. Like, he'll be kind of mean. And I don't mind that. I just am like, fine, what do you want then? You know, I'll just kind of sass him back. You know, I feel like we're kind of like brother and sister or something. But, you know, some people might be more sensitive if you talk to them like that. And I don't really get offended like that. So,
have you seen any of the players get offended? Any of the people you'd brought in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a few people that I brought in that were like, I just don't understand what he wants. He's really stressing me out. Like, you know, because they would maybe be more like, they just, also he changes, he'll sing, he'll ask you to do something that's tricky and you're learning it on the fly. And then he'll say, no, change the 4th and 7th note. So you're going, and he's like, no, change the 4th note and the 7th note. And so you're like, no, change it to a different note. No, change it different. You know, so it's a little bit intense, and you have to kind of be able to ride with it.
Yeah. And this is all without written music.
No, not written. He doesn't write.
I mean, just a lot of these, you know, kind of session players, you know, especially more classically trained instruments, like they kind of rely on sheet music. And so I could see them getting really frustrated, flustered.
Right. So at some point he did have a couple of people in that were better at, you know, chart writing. I can do it a little bit, but I'm not great at it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be doing any of that particular stuff, but, yeah, I would eventually like know to kind of communicate with people a little bit, like, here's the thing. He's going to send you a track or not. You'll be doing it on the fly. And you got to kind of learn what he's trying to sing you. Sometimes I would go in and kind of be a little bit of the translator, like, know what he wants is. I think what he's asking you is to do this. So I'm saying, I mean, he's funny to work with, and I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just his way of doing it. It's how he gets, you know, he needs to hear all a bunch of variations, and then he knows what he wants. He's like, that's what I want. So to me, that's clear. I like it.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad, only at Zaxby's.
What was Dance Hall Crashers' first like interaction with Fat Mike or Fat Records or whatever? I know that they re-released basically the old record in 96. I don't know if you had worked with them before that or not.
We had played shows with them. I can't remember what I have a terrible memory, but I can't remember what our first show with them was. But we did a fair amount of Warped Tour, so I want to say that might be. But then we also did European Warped Tour. We opened for them for a series of dates. Probably my most memorable weird one was in Copenhagen. I think, was it Copenhagen or Oslo? I think it was Copenhagen. And it was us, NoFX, and the Misfits in the tiniest, weirdest club that held like 300 people. Or like, it was just so random. And I think I'll always just be like this, you know, I have this memory of that show as being like this very strange combo of bands, you know, especially because I was so poppy and like backstage of the Misfits. And I'm like terrified. They're so big and scary. But I can't remember the very first time we played with them. But then, you know, we became friends and through that, and they saw us play a lot. And then Elise, the other singer for Dancehall Crashers, was our manager. And she, I think she approached them about it, or maybe they approached us about it, but we all spent a lot of time together. Like I said, the Fat Records is in San Francisco, and Mike and Mel and me and like all live in San Francisco. They don't anymore, but we all did. And Aaron. And so there was a lot of time hanging out, which was really fun and cool. And so they approached us about doing or re-releasing it. And it was a great fit. Yeah.
What can you tell us about the song Triple Track on the Short Music for Short People comp?
I mean, it's just a totally silly. We're just basically dropping his name just to be sassy. I don't know. I think that, you know, you get given this assignment. Can you write a 30-second song? You're like, what the fuck am I? Like, what do you say in 30 seconds? Like, you can't. It's like very difficult to get something like concise. So we didn't really get in a fight with him, obviously, but it was just this, we're like, what can we just throw together that's poppy and fun and silly in like 30 seconds? So yeah, got in a fight with Fat Mike when he called and told me to write a 30 second song for his little, you know, it was just a total joke. Dancehall Crashers is obviously like highly sardonic and sarcastic, and that's kind of always been our a little bit of our MO. So why not do it there and drop his name in there? Like, what else are we gonna write about? Like, what do you write? You just like can't write a, like, you know, let's change the world meaningful song in 30. Doesn't quite. I mean, those songs are hard to write anyway. It's definitely harder to write in a 30 second version of something like that.
You mentioned before that you you grew up in England. Your mom did traveling theater when you were a little kid, and that you participated in that.
Yeah, my mom is a pretty wild woman. Both of my parents are pretty eccentric and wild humans, I would say. They're both so differently eccentric, but eccentric that I kind of always felt like, there's nothing I can do to rebel against them. Like, it's just, we were living in England, and, you know, like, it's kind of housing estate, sort of bad neighborhood, shitty, depressed England, which it really was in the 70s, right? So, she just decided, like, I don't want to be a bored housewife, single mom. This is like a boring life. So I'm going to buy a van, build beds in the back, and rent our house out illegally. At the time, you can't do that. You can't rent out, like, basically, you know, government housing. We had a nice big house in those days. You could get nice big houses. So we're going to rent our house out illegally, and we're going to go play street theater all through Europe. And I'm going to just take my two kids. And I was 7 and my brother was 6. And it was just the 3 of us, my mom and the 2 of us. And she had chicken costumes made for me and my brother by a friend who made like amazing costumes for TV. And she dressed like a clown, like a male clown. And we would drive through France, Spain, Switzerland, like the Pompidou Center in Paris was our first stop. And then we went all through the south of France and into Switzerland and then down through Spain into Morocco. And we went to Gibraltar and lived there for a month. And we played street theater, like in the little towns. We would get into, like, go to the, you know, main plaza and set up our little theater-ish thing. And people would throw in money, and then we would take that money, go get dinner, and, you know, get back in our van and drive to the next city or town. It was totally crazy. My mom, I was just like, I can't believe that, like, talking about it now is even crazier to think that she managed to do that. And we did that for like 7 months.
What did that feel at the time though, as a kid? Like, did that feel weird or did it feel just fun?
Well, I think when you're that age, you adjust to anything. You know, you don't, of course it was weird and wild and crazy. And there were a few scary moments. But I mean, I think it was a little easier for me than my younger brother. He is just naturally a little bit more of an introvert, but I was just like, let's stay. You know, like for me, I think I was always just drawn to the stage a little bit. I didn't mind it. And I felt safe with my mom. She's very, you know, stable and protective, even though she's also kind of a total eccentric. So, you know, we learned how to read maps. We learned languages. We learned how to deal with different kinds of people. We communicated, ate different kinds of, you know, amazing food. We were reading the map for her all the way through, like, you know, little towns, you know, little villages and up the mountains, you know, of Spain, and like going into Morocco and like learning about all these different cultures. So to me, it was a phenomenal experience, but I think any fears I had, you just kind of go with the flow at that age. You're just like, well, this is what we do. You know, and as an adult, you probably have more fears, you know, and more like, that's a crazy thing to do. But at the time you're like, well, yeah, cool. You just go with it. Right.
Do you have any pictures of you with your brother in the chicken costumes?
We have hardly any photographs. It's really sad, but my mom did like write a journal of the entire thing, and she did like lots of little drawings. So we have some of that, but we don't have, I think we have like one photograph. It's really kind of sad. Mm-hmm. I know. I don't know why she wasn't better about that, but I guess it was just too many things to do. And, you know, pre-cell phone days where you have,
even you're traveling in a van, there's only so much you can carry too.
Yeah. But I mean, even still, I'm just like a little sad. Like a couple places we stopped, I think, and we stayed with like friends here and there, like in Switzerland, we stayed for a week. And then when we went to Morocco, we ended up staying with some friends of friends. But so I think there's one or two photographs, but they're crappy and they're like not, it's not, it's unfortunately, we don't have like a really good one. I have to harass her about that. But we do have her journal, which is like giving us, you know, like all kinds of crazy stories that happened. Like we ran out of, our van broke down on the top of the mountain. We had to coast all the way down, like, you know, these Spanish hills to like this little village. And then just like long stories that I won't get into, but some pretty wild stuff. Yeah.
Now you have this journal so you can look back this time, but do you have actual very many memories of this time?
Yeah, I do. I have very strong visual memories that feel pretty epic and dreamlike, you know, like Morocco is, the light is very different. And, you know, and then there would be like, you know, when you get to Spain, you see like lemon trees and tangerine trees, and like growing up in England, that's dark and depressing, you know, things like that are like, it just looks like magic. And so a lot of visual kind of strong sort of imprints, I think, on my mind that probably come up in dreams and songwriting. And, you know, they're very like, yeah, I have a lot of memories. I was 7, wasn't too young.
So while you still lived in England, you were introduced to or involved with different subcultures like punk and, I don't know, like ska, I assume you got into ska at that point.
Yeah, I have an older brother as well that was a punk and a mod, 7 years older than me. And it was just a big part of our teen life, you know. So I got totally obsessed with the Specials, and me and my, you know, friends, and a couple of us had older brothers and older sisters. So I think they also got us into it. But, you know, Blondie, the Specials, I was just a huge music, Althea and Donna, seeing them for the first time on TV. It's like, that's why Uptown Top Ranking is always one of my favorite songs, because I, seeing them on TV. Well, also my parents were really, my mom and my stepdad, we listened to a lot of Toots and the Maytals and Bob Marley and a lot of ska, Desmond Dekker and stuff. So for us, it was always a big deal musically, and I was such a, you know, I was singing from a very early age, and I always knew it's something I wanted to do. I was very, very clear on that. But then getting into subcultures and ska stuff, you know, we were, you know, little punk rockers and rude girls at age 11, going to shows as what we could go to. And then, you know, watching Top of the Pops and Funboy 3. I was obsessed with Funboy 3. And then, yeah, and then I moved to the States and it continued from there. But
how was the subcultures different when you got to the East Bay? Did it seem like a different world to you?
Absolutely. People were a lot more racist and a lot more mean in England. I would say, like, I remember coming to Berkeley and walking down the BART station, and I kind of tripped and fell a little bit. And there were a bunch of punk rockers at the top of the stairs. And I remember just being terrified, like, oh my God, they're going to laugh at me. So I was 12 years old. I just moved here. I was like, they're going to laugh at me, like mean punks in England, you know, always would have. They were like, hey, you fucking idiot. Something like that. And they were like, hey, are you okay? I was like, what? I would say there was just, it's just rougher. You know, my dad lived in London and I grew up in Cambridge, but even going to London, you know, my dad lived in Brixton, like when the Brixton riots happened, and everything felt like harder and rougher and much more scary. There was a lot of, you know, the National Front would drive down the street with speakers on top of the cars and like trying to get you to join the National Front.
Wow.
You know, like that's why the Specials and everybody were doing these like anti-racism songs, because it was very real in a much more open way in some ways than here. Like, of course, racism is there 100%, but it's like, pretend, like, I think the US like pretends like it's not there. Well, in the UK, it was like out there, totally, obviously.
And it was very focused on immigrants too, right? Like, we want immigrants out of this country.
Yeah. It's so nationalistic, especially at that time. It was really bad. But I never felt like, my parents are both Czech, so I always felt a tiny bit like an outsider, even though I was born and raised there. And then coming to the States, just the adjustment, I think that sunny California is a big culture shock for any English people. It's like everybody's kind of just more happy. Like, I don't know. It just, you really are depressed in England in the early 80s. You know, it's like, ugh, Thatcher, and everything was just a nightmare. So I think the scenes were quite different. Yeah, but in Berkeley, you know, there was the Gilman punk scene, which felt a little more similar. You know, it was kind of rough and tumble there, and it didn't feel too clean cut. It wasn't like Southern California. I know that Southern California had a lot of fighting and all that kind of stuff, but yeah, it was a culture shock. But I didn't know any of the California bands. That's why, like, Fishbone and even Op Ivy, I was like late to come to that, because my background was the Specials and the Selector and Madness and, you know, Althea and Donna and Thumboy 3 and that kind of scene, you know.
So before you joined Dancehall Crashers, what was your awareness or introduction to California ska music?
Well, my brother, my younger brother, who's a year younger than me, is a Scooter Boy. And he and I lived with my mom pretty close to Gilman Street. So we would go to shows, and he had a big whole Scooter scene that he was into. So, and he was really into the mod scene as well, which is a little different, but, and the punk scene, but kind of getting into the Scooter Boy scene, and we would go to Scooter rallies. There was Scooter shows all the time. And so it was like, Let's Go Bowling and Skank and Pickle and all these, you know, California bands that were playing at these Scooter shows and these Scooter rallies and Hepcat, like Gangster Fun. There were a bunch of kind of introductions to the California ska scene that way. And then I joined Dancehall Crashers via my brother's, you know, connection, because one of his good friends was like kind of co-managing and toasting and kind of singing in Dancehall Crashers, and was all, you know, part of the Black Sheep Scooter Club. And there's a bunch of different Scooter Club scenes, like Vespa, Lambretta scenes. So yeah, just the sound of that is a, you know, that's sort of like, that was my introduction to the scooter scene. And the ska scene, my brother fixing his scooter all the time, all day long.
Do you know how long Dancehall Crushers existed before you joined?
About 8 months, I think. I don't know if it was not even a full year.
And so Tim and Matt had already come and gone at that point. And Elise was already in the band before you joined?
Yeah, Elise had joined a few months earlier. I want to say 6 months earlier. Jason had been in it pretty much since the beginning. But Elise was joined. There was a woman named Ingrid. And then Elise joined after Ingrid. And Elise was going to Cal, Berkeley Cal. That's why she would get that, because she's from Orange County. She's, you know, knows all the No Doubt. You know, she's good friends with Gwen and all the No Doubt guys. So, but she'd been in about 6 months before I had, so they did record a demo. And then we are kind of notorious, Dancehall Crashers, as having some of the biggest lineup changes of any band in the East Bay. It's like everybody came through that band. It was like Andrew from Screw 32, Grant, lots of people that you probably, are not worth mentioning necessarily, because they maybe didn't end up in other bands, but like East Bay scene, punk rockers, like Joey, like six different horn players, like recycling through, Joel Wing, who's a big, ska guy, who's actually just been posting a bunch of cool, like, memories on Instagram recently. He was in the band at the time. Eric was our drummer, Eric Larson. So there's like all these, like, and then it like shifted again. When I got into it, we had a few more dropouts and a few more additions. Jamie McCormick, who's an awesome guitar player. So we're kind of like notorious as having been the family tree of Dancehall Crashers is probably the biggest, the Bay Area ska punk. Yeah. Like, no one stayed in that band. And then finally we got our core group, and even that shifted a couple of times, you know? So I joined in 1989, right after, I think in the summer of 89. I don't think I was in high school. I think I just finished high school.
We'll be right back after this.
You guys did the Earth Day Festival in 1990. Now, that was like your last show of that era before you broke up? Or was that, is that true or no?
No, I don't think it was the last show. No, we played some more after that, but we didn't play a whole lot longer after that. I think we played, because we did a tour. No, we didn't do that. Let's see. We did a bunch of like LA shows or Southern California things. And then we broke up, you know, and more local things. And then we broke up, but it wasn't our last.
For people who weren't around this era, how many people would you say, this is at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, how many people would you say showed up to that event?
I mean, it was pretty much a full house, and I can't remember the capacity there, but I want to say it's like, I'm probably totally wrong. I think it's like 7,000.
Yeah, somewhere around there, 7, 8. Yeah.
It could be 5 or 6. It was a full house. It was stunning, and it was, you know, I was very nervous. Yeah, it was a big deal to play that show. It was packed house. I mean, the English Beat, whatever they were called, something they were called like
the International Beat.
International Beat, right. The time. That was a big deal. Bad Manners, which I was like massive fan of in England. So that was just like incredibly starstruck. But it was a big deal for us, obviously. It was the biggest crowd that I had ever played for. And,
yeah.
And just to see like, oh, there's all these people that are into ska. Like, here it is. And here's this amazing mixture of bands that are pretty different.
Yeah, it was like Me, Mom, and Morgan Taller from Canada, Gangster Fun.
Yeah.
Let's Go Bowling.
Yeah. Donkey Show, I think, did that one too, right?
Donkey Show. Yeah, they were on that.
You know, which also like three other girl center, you know, bands with girls in it, which was a thing too. I think a lot of people say like, we're the only ones, but it's like, no, there's all these other girls.
I want to ask you about, so there's a video of like a public access thing that Tim Armstrong hosted that you guys are featured pretty heavily in.
Here we are backstage, the Greek, and we're going to go out and talk to some of these people who are enjoying the ska festival here on Earth Day. Come on, let's go.
When he comes to our rehearsal, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so there's footage of you guys at rehearsal, and there's also footage of him at Earth Day interviewing people.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've watched it many times, and I'm very fascinated by like what the context was. Did Tim have like a public access show, or was this like a one-off?
I think he did. I don't think it was very long-lived, but he did have it a brief window of time that he was doing that. Yeah, he was like running around interviewing, you know, the scene, which is so cool. It's like another, you know, kind of like Fat Mike, like they've been advocators of the scene and like documenting. That's a big deal. It's such a big deal because like, it's so cool to be able to look back at that. But yeah, he was doing this all access TV show. So funny. And it's just so great to have it. I mean, it's, you know, that footage to me personally is embarrassing. I'm like, oh God, I look like an idiot. But I so appreciate that it's there, of course.
I think it's cool too, because like, I mean, I don't know the story or history, but like he started That's All Crashers, and then he left the band, but he seemed like he obviously was down with you guys. Like there didn't seem like there was any issue with the fact that he wasn't in the band, and he seemed happy to, you know, highlight you guys. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was totally amicable. He was, you know, again, he's down for the scene. He's down for the camaraderie of keeping this stuff together. And, you know, many of us had known him before Dance Hall Crashers had even started. Like I said, there was like tons of warehouse punk rock parties that I would see him at. And, you know, it's a scene. It was like, back then it was like, that's where you'd see everybody. I don't think there was any issues. It was totally amicable. So yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. I mean, he wrote a song for us after that, you know, on Jaw. He wrote pictures for us. So, you know, I think he wanted to keep his, like, we've always given him that credit. He wrote Dance Hall Crashers, that song, which is our theme song. Like we kept that on the album, you know, like it was totally amicable. We had some people where it wasn't maybe so amicable, but whatever. You can't be friends with everybody.
My introduction to Dance Hall Crashers was the California Ska Quake comp, mm-hmm. which was like early, it was like 1992. It was like a California comp. and it had your song "He Wants Me Back." That song and the Hepcat song "Ooh Ooh Hi Hi" were like my two favorite songs off that comp. I think that was my introduction to Hepcat too, now that I think about it.
Yeah, I wrote that song with Jamie. What were you gonna say? Sorry, what were you gonna?
I was gonna ask you like, yeah, how that song came about.
I mean, I wanted to kind of write a girl power-ish song, but it was actually kind of a true story, so a little partly embellishment for the hell of the song. But Jamie McCormick was our second guitar player besides Jason at the time. I love Jamie's playing. He had this like really, he's still a good friend, great musician. And he had this really great way of like playing ska, like he had that like all that cool stuff, which I loved. And it was a bit more kind of old school and trad style. And we were good buddies. And so he came up with that part and just like the chord progression. And I just loved the fact that it sounded to me like a bit of more of an old ska tune, you know, and even like, you know, a little bit like the Selector or something like. And so I wanted to kind of, you know, I was a big fan of like, and Pauline Black. I'm just a huge fan of Pauline Black. So I think I was trying to kind of slightly rip that off a little bit, like, and Althea and Donna, like these kind of female, even though they're kind of speaking in their song, but I kind of wanted this like duo girl vibe on that, you know, the Bell Stars, another big, you know, I was a big fan of the Bell Stars. And so I was trying to kind of do that, like, you know, yesterday the leaves are brown and I was wearing a big frown, you know, just having this kind of like, because my lover left, like, I was kind of trying to get this like kind of sunny, tide is high vibe on it. That was sort of what I was shooting for. And then the lyrics are sort of like a playful joke at whatever. I had a series of stupid dudes that I dated at one point, and I was like, great. This is really good fodder for a book. You know, it's good. It's good. It's good material.
I'm really curious, actually, and this applies to any part of the Dancehall Crashers, any era. How did you approach the singing? Because you had two, you and Elise, you guys are both singing leads. You guys are singing in unison at times. You guys are singing harmonies at time. Was it really well planned and thought out, or was it kind of?
Oh yeah. I mean, you mean, was it well rehearsed and all that kind of?
Was it kind of like, I guess like you guys, would you guys sit down and really like, I guess kind of like write out the vocal part?
Well, write out by ear, not by.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not obviously not by music, but I mean, not sheet music or anything, but written out, but oh yeah, absolutely. We would try all kinds of different things. We'd, you know, sit together and work on vocals all the time. And I remember the first time we actually recorded anything, which was "Keep on Running" in the studio. You know, we'd been rehearsing and musically hit it off right away. I mean, I'm a total harmony obsessed fanatic, you know, like the Beatles and I don't know, everything. ABBA. Even a nerdy ABBA fan as a kid, and but definitely like Beatles big time, and you know, so many other bands, Eurythmics, all kinds of people that use a lot of harmonies. But we kind of clicked pretty fast actually musically, like, oh, and then I'm gonna say I'm pretty good at blending, so singing unison is a very tricky thing to do actually, because you have to use the exact inflection that somebody is using on that word. And you have to end the word exactly where they end it. You have to start it. Your plosives have to match. Like there's a lot of like tricky little things, but we somehow really got that connection very fast. If you want to get into singer nerd talk.
I find it super interesting. Yeah. I mean, no, I just, it sounds like, you know, you listen to it casually and you're like, this is great. But then when you listen to it closely, you're like, there's really a lot of thought. Like really a lot of thought. It seems like there's a lot of thought put into like really making it sound right. Like, I don't think at first listen, you think that because you just hear nice sounding vocals, right?
Thank you. Yeah, but harmony is, but harmony and singing, I mean, first of all, I love it. And so I'm a total nerd about it. And, you know, I'm sure she is too, but I'll speak for myself about how we figure out stuff. We would, you know, we would sing sections and be like, this should be like, let's sing this part in unison because it's a little bit more effective. It's a little bit more, it just sounds better, or a harmony wasn't working for whatever reasons. And then we would like break out into harmony, and sometimes I'm singing the higher part, but sometimes she's singing the higher part. And there's also a lot of sections where, I mean, often I would end up doing the higher range, you know, because I have a pretty big high range, but there's a lot of songs where I go above her and then come back into unison and then go below her and then come and then hit a high note. Like, we're doing a lot of weaving in and out in certain things, where it's not just like, I'm only singing the high part and you're only singing the low part. You know, like, I don't know, Cold Fall is one of our songs that where I do like, I go up and then below her and then above, and there, or Othello, I think. Like, there's certain songs where there's a lot of random movement, and I don't know if I would have that same patience. I don't know, man. But we it was fun. Like, we had a lot of fun with creating that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like that's an approach vocally you don't hear from a lot of bands or a lot of vocalists, like taking the high road and then taking the low part and then going back to the high part. Like, can you think of any others that you took maybe influence from for that? Or was that seems like a pretty original thought.
I definitely think the Beatles do it.
Mm.
You know, they do. But I think, you know, once you have a melody line, not all harmonies on the higher range will always work, or you'll get into a section where it just sounds like the high part just gets too high. Mm. If you continue to do a high range, what works with the chord is obviously going to have to be the most important. But yeah, so sometimes the melody gets a little lost because we do so much of that. But I think that, you know, one person, we wrote songs together a lot, but also a lot of times we would write with our guitar player. Jason would send us like a cassette tape of like a chord progression, and then we would work separately where I'd be like, oh, I'm kind of, you know, digging on song number two on that little cassette tape he gave us. And she's like, okay, well, I'm working on song number three anyways. So then we would kind of come up with a big, like a structure to some degree vocally. So then the harmony, adding the harmony player or second, you know, harmony and second voice, then we'd sort of be like, work around that harmony. So back to your question, I mean, I think the Beatles definitely do it because they sing as a duo a lot. You know, John and Paul did a lot of, I mean, of course, George is in there, but they do a lot of duo vocals, which means that there are times that they cross over. I mean, I'm sure Beach Boys, I mean, a lot of people probably do it for sure. But yeah, once you get into three part and four part, tends to be that you probably stay in your section.
Yeah, sure.
But I think with two vocals, you might, in order to keep the melody the most kind of important, your backgrounds have to adjust around the chord a little bit.
Interesting. That's super interesting to me. I want to kind of like, so there is this version of the band ends and restarts and then becomes sort of a different band where it's like no horns, a little bit heavier. So can you kind of speak on what kind of leads us to that?
Yeah, it was a conscious decision. I mean, I'll say that, you know, having three horn players, two vocals, and two guitarists, which is what we had in the early days, and we even had a keyboard player actually briefly, I mean, for the early days, that's just the logistics of that. I mean, not just a tour, which is expensive, but even just getting along and getting a rehearsal scheduled and like the basic logistics of that, you know, like totally props to like Hepcat and all the other bands that do that, because it's a lot of people to deal with, you know, and a lot of personalities and everyone's got whatever, all that stuff. So, but also in addition, like we did a fair amount of tours with like maybe one horn player. Like we had Dean Olmstead from Let's Go Bowling played with us for a while. We had Matt Morrish, who has been in the English Beat until recently. We're the first ska band that he ever played with, which is really kind of funny. Because like years later, it's like, that's right, you're in the English Beat now. And so we're super good buddies, and it's kind of cute because he was a jazzer before.
Yeah.
And I think that we were his first like ska band. Just like a friend of, I think, Jason's from, and then we had, you know, Knuckle Brothers, a couple guys from Knuckle Brothers, and then Brian, who ended up in Save Ferris. And Mike Park did a couple tours with us. We had sections of, we would have like one sax player or something like that. But ultimately with two vocalists and two guitarists, which we had most of the time, two guitarists, there's just a lot going on anyway. Like two lead vocals is a lot with all those harmonies that we were doing. So it kind of just didn't feel like we needed all of that extra stuff in addition to the logistics. And then I think really made a conscious effort to shift into kind of the more punk pop sound. I mean, I wanted to always go a little bit more new wave than we did, you know, but that wasn't in the cards with everybody else. But I think that we did kind of want to pull away from like being kind of sounding like everybody else in the 90s ska kind of wave that was coming up, because we felt like other people were doing that. And we were kind of more leaning into like kind of digging on, you know, pop punk stuff anyway, like NOFX and Green Day and whatever else was, you know, the Muffs and, you know, a lot of bands that we just were kind of more into at the time. And we just didn't want to get stuck in like, we do like, ba, 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 you know, I love the music, but it had been 10 years at that point or whatever. We were like, let's do a little something different. And we can't tour with 10 people.
The band basically broke up for a little bit and then reformed. When you reformed, did you come reformed as this version of the band?
Pretty much. Yeah, it did. And that's when we had maybe one person playing with us for a while, or, you know, a couple of people, like I said, but they were like guests. We were going to keep the core band as the six piece. And we had like a few songs on the record that might have some horns. And then maybe we would have, you know, somebody tour with us, and they would do like our friends, like Mike Park and Dean and stuff. Dean was actually with us for a little while, because it was when Let's Go Bowling had broken up. And so, yeah, we were very clear on keeping our sort of core six piece and then adding horns here and there, but not going back to the full horn section. And we got a lot of shit for it. I mean, you know, you got your like punk rock police out there. The ska police is just as bad. They're like, we hate them now that they dropped the horns. It's like, all right. I mean, we got so much shit about that. It was ridiculous. Like letters, you know, like, can't believe you dropped the
letters.
Oh yeah. Cause it was like pre-internet. So like people were just like, I can't believe you dropped it. It's like, oh, poor you.
It's kind of funny that a crappy internet comment used to just have to be a letter. Like they'd actually have to go to the trouble to write it and put a stamp on it and send it to you.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work to be a jerk.
You gotta sit down and write a letter about it.
How was touring with Mike Park?
Fun. We didn't do like tons of actual touring with him, but I know, you know, we're good friends because my very first show that I ever played with Dance Hall was with Skank and Pickle and Swingin' Utters, who were called Johnny P. Bucks and the Swingin' Utters at that time. It was a very memorable show for me. So we've been friends with them for a very long time with Skank and Pickle.
Where was that show at?
At this weird club called Club Commotion in San Francisco in the Mission. It was kind of an underground club, and it was run by one of the guys from the Looters, which was a local band. And, you know, they did all kinds of like punk rock shows and I don't know, all these local bands like the Freaky Executives and all these kind of weird kind of punky post-punk stuff. But anyway, touring with Mike Park was fun. I mean, he's a lunatic, and he was at that time, like in a good way. He's just got tons of energy, and he's really ridiculous and very funny and like very smart. And I mean, we didn't, like I said, we didn't tour with him a ton. He did a couple of things with us, but
yeah.
It's fun. I mean, we're still good buddies. He just released a song that I sang on. I loved Skanking Pickle at the time. I really liked their take on stuff. They were really fun and high energy. And
yeah, that was my intro to ska, was Skanking Pickle. Yeah.
Live, really fun. I'm actually really good friends with Lars still, who plays a lot of keyboards now, but was a sax. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is he in now? The Boars? Is that one?
The Boars. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He actually gave me a little keyboard organ lessons when I first joined. NoFX. I was like, oh, I need some help. I called him up. I was like, could you just give me some good little organ tips?
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So Dancehall Crashers were signed to 510 Records was the record for Lockjaw, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a subsidiary of MCA.
So you were the first act that 510 signed, right?
I believe so. But they were working with, you know, they were managing, those guys were managing Green Day, and you know, there was like the Jawbreaker, the Muffs connection. So we were at least kind of connected to, you know, the Muffs and Jawbreaker more specifically than Green Day, but meaning as far as our connection. And but I think we were the first signing. I think we were.
So what was that like? I mean, you get this record label deal. You have Lockjaw, then you have Hi Honey, I'm Homely. Is that the correct name?
Yeah, Honey, I'm Homely.
So it's kind of this really marks a new era for the band. I think when I think of it, it's like these records.
Yeah. Well, we had a little, there was a bunch of stuff going on. We had been writing songs at that point for a while. We were ready to put something out. We were doing a new sound. We were dropping the horns pretty much. And we just had, you know, more invested people in the band, and it was a real good core group. We also had Scott Goodell playing guitar, and Mikey was on bass at that point. And Mikey is a great bass player and was just an awesome person. We're very good friends still. And Scott Goodell is a killer guitar player and had great songwriting ideas. And so we were, and he's just a fun guy. So he, lovely person. So he really brought a lot to it, I think, as well. Like, a great, like, Jason is our other guitar player, and he's been the primary songwriter throughout, between, you know, him and me and Elise kind of like wrote everything at that point. But it was fun to have like Mikey's little, you know, ideas thrown in there. And Scott had lots of cool ideas, a really great rhythm player as well as the lead player. So I think we kind of hit a good stride of like trying to, he's a big music fan, like just kind of getting into all the stuff we hadn't had a chance to do. It'd been years since the old record had been written and released. And we were kids. We were like 18. You know, now we're not kids. We're like 23, you know. So we had a lot more fun things to say at that point. Besides, whatever.
With 510, did you guys have like a lot of support? Was it? What, did it feel like you were in a major, or I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. Yes and no. We didn't get like a huge, like, it's kind of funny because we got a little bit of thrown into the, like, you sell out things, which was a big stupid deal in the 90s, which always just made me laugh because number one, we were on like a subsidiary. So we weren't even on a major when all these other bands did go to majors. Right. So we never got like that, some big advance. That never happened to us. We got support for touring and for videos and for making the record. But now 510 dismantled pretty fast, and then we were on MCA, and we did get financial support for, you know, making the record like any label should do, and, you know, PR budgets and stuff like that. But of course, we have to recoup everything, and they want to spend way more money on that shit than, you know, an independent label. But so, like, you know, like the budgets for certain things were just stupid. Like our video budget was like ridiculous, and our catering at that, you know, I remember just being like, wow, that's a fancy catering, you know, like later realizing, oh, I got to pay all that back. Like it's, you know, it's kind of because they're like, you're on a major now, so now we're going to spend like 30 times more on this video than we need to spend just because, you know. So did we get a lot of support? Not really. I mean, like we got those things, but then those things were much higher budgets than they should have been.
Yeah.
And then, and we had to recoup it. But the other thing is that MCA, like, basically fired and rehired their staff right as our album was coming out twice. So we just got screwed. Like it was like our A&R person, all of our team, and that is in fake quotes because it's like whatever, but they all got fired and rehired because it was these crazy shuffle, major label shuffle things going down. So we got pretty fucked, you know. We weren't like in this great zone of like, because then, you know, you get a new staff and they're like, well, we didn't invest in your record and we don't have any, you know, any reason to push your album because like, I want to be part of the next thing. But like, so we got kind of like lost in that big mess, you know, a couple of times. It was kind of a tragic sort of moment. Like, so the fact that we were getting all these, like, for a little window of time, like, you sell out. It's like,
oh. You think a bigger part of why you guys got targeted as being sellouts was that you had women in the band? Do you think it was some weird misogynistic thing?
No, I don't actually. There's plenty of other misogynistic things that I would say were problematic, but I wouldn't say it was that so much. I think people just, you know, want to whine about any old damn thing. And to them, they thought it was our special scene, you know, of course, not kind of taking into consideration that bands like The Specials and Madness and all of their other favorite ska bands were on labels and major labels. Like, it was just so stupid to me because also, frankly, you know, growing up in England in like housing estates, and like, I just felt like these rich, entitled California kids that go to McDonald's every day, buy clothes from the Gap, like, they are so corporate. Everything they do is like, they don't rebel against anything. They're not politically correct about anything else except for this one goddamn issue, which all we're doing is providing music to people. Yeah. And we are expanding the ability to do that potentially, maybe, by being on a label that might want to, you know, further our sound to, you know, smaller places and yeah, smaller towns where there is no scene and they can't get, you know, good records, or people don't come and play shows there. So like, to me, it was just the most ridiculous complaint. Like, really, if you're so like, you know, anti, you know, corporations, then don't go to McDonald's. Stop wearing your, like, you know, like people that are doing actually evil things. Like, yeah, the major label is shitty. Major labels are shitty. Completely agreed on that. However, they're not like, you know, they don't have like, you know, child labor issues and things like that. It was like, it's a corporate American issue, which could be, you know, better, but like, stop eating at, you know, fast food restaurants that are screwing the world. Like, that is, if you really want to make a statement about something that matters, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah.
And that's No, I don't think it was misogynistic, actually. Yeah. But like I said, there's plenty of other things that were.
Sure.
Of those two records, I know you guys didn't have like a huge song in like constant radio rotation, but you did have songs kind of get out there. Like what song or songs do you feel like was the most kind of known from that era? Was it maybe Go or?
Yeah, Enough, Go.
Lost Again, did that song get out much? Or is that more just like a fan favorite?
Yeah, I think that's more of a fan favorite because Enough was on some, you know, soundtracks and like video, you know, surf videos. And we had like the Angus soundtrack. That was kind of a lot of people were introduced to us through that. I think Go, we did video for Go and Enough. And so those like got on MTV for like on 120 minutes, like twice or something. And so like, you know, there was like K-Rock might've played it once or something, you know, like we got a little bit of something. And I think that those were our singles that were pushed that didn't really go very far, but at least somehow between that and a few soundtracks that we were on and, you know, comps and things like that. I mean, that's why He Wants Me Back is, like you mentioned, is such a fave, because comps are really helpful with that. Just introducing, you know, people to, you know, bands that you've never heard of. It's a great tool, obviously. So I think probably Enough, Go. And then in Hawaii, we did really well and they were really into Truly Comfortable. That was one of their big faves because that was, I don't know, you know, Hawaii's got their own like.
Yeah, they have their own, at the time they had their own radio, their own charting. Yeah, it was pretty cool actually.
Very cool. It was like all by voting and like, yeah, it was very cool. And then Lost Again is a favorite. You know, it's also often like the first song on your album. And then in Japan, they loved Queen for a Day randomly. So that, but also first song on our, oh, no, they love Queen for a Day, but they also love Shelly. Shelly was their big thing, which is very funny and cute because they sing it with their accent and it's really cute.
Did you hear in 2020 during COVID, there was like the online version of Lost Again by Half Past Two and like Bite Me Bambi, Cat Bite, all of them, Ska Tune Network. You heard that?
Yeah. God, it's so good. Lost Again. I know, like, damn, you're doing better than us. Shit. It was so good. It was, like, amazing. Yeah.
So you kind of like get to 99, I think. You kind of start going on a hiatus and kind of going like in the 2000s, you're still playing, but you're not playing as much, right?
Mm-hmm.
When is your last show as Dancehall Crushers?
You know, it's funny. I know that 2021, you know, we had to cancel a tour after September 11th. Sorry, not 2021, 2001. God, time flies. We had to cancel going to Japan. We were supposed to go to Japan and we had to cancel that when 2001 happened. And then we ended up rescheduling for like a year and a half later. And it was not long after that, but I want to say 2004 might have been our last show, but I don't even remember where our last show was.
Wow.
I'd have to look that up. Isn't that weird? I don't think we were doing it like a big, like, this is our final show ever. You know, I definitely I know that we had kind of decided to call it off sometime after the Japan stuff was like when we were like, we'll reschedule that. Let's do Japan. We love Japan. And then, yeah, we did, you know, we did our live DVD and all that stuff. So, but it was kind of like, I can't remember where our last show. Isn't that terrible?
Dang. That's wild.
So you had no idea your last show was your last show is what I'm guessing.
Yeah. Or else it just didn't feel like it was. Yeah, I don't think that we were like, this is our last show ever. God, I cannot believe I can't remember that. Isn't that terrible? I have such a bad memory sometimes. I have to ask the guys and release, and then I will remember where it was, but I can't believe I can't remember that. Isn't that terrible? It wasn't like it was some dramatic thing. I personally didn't want to do it anymore. And Elise at the same time didn't want to do it anymore. And it was totally not aggressive or upsetting. I was just like, I think I'm done. And she's like, I am too. And it was just kind of like, okay. And so we, you know, did the last few shows that we were going to do. And maybe we thought we would probably get together again at some point. And it wasn't, because it wasn't some big dramatic ending. I mean, I remember driving home from the last show, strangely. So it must have been LA or something. I remember with the boys driving home. Where the hell was it? And they were kind of like bummed and like talking to me about it. And I was like, I'm just kind of done. And like, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't dramatic, but maybe because I can't even remember it, I just didn't feel like it was some huge deal. I mean, I did on some level, of course. It's weird to end, you know, I was in the band for 18 years.
Wow. Whoa.
Like when I did the math at the time. So yeah, like, actually I could count that and figure out exactly. I think it was 2004, but I was like, you know, it's a big deal to end such a long, you know, long thing. And I think that, you know, it's going to be intense for the NoFX guys. It's 40 years. It's a long time.
Yeah. Wow.
Your whole life.
Has there ever been talk about doing a Dance Hall Crashers reunion?
I know the question that everybody asks me. There has been, it's not in the cards. I don't think it'll happen. So I don't want to get anyone's hopes up. I don't really think it'll happen. There are certain people that would be more up for it than others. I'm not totally against it, but there's some reasons that it'd be hard for me. But it's not like a bad thing. It's just like, I mean, I don't even know if I can run around like that on stage and like it was hard work. That band is hard work. Like for me, I was like running around and jumping like a lunatic, like what you do when you're in your early 20s, and I'm old now. Like that's hard to do.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, like I really was incredibly physically active in that band and singing those harmonies, like to do it like that, you know, if I was only doing one or the other, I'm, you know, there's a reason that, you know, whatever, Tina Turner is such a badass that she could still do that shit, but it's hard to do. So I, there's talk of it at times once in a while. And like the offers that we've had have just not been anything that anyone's like, you know, the joke was for a while, like, listen, if we get an offer to play with Devo in Japan, you know, or whatever, like one of our favorite bands or something, like then maybe we would do it. But otherwise it's like, do we want to play, you know, Ska Fest or blah, blah, blah. No offense to anybody. It's not about that. It's just like, we're all spread out around the country. You know, everybody's in different places. Everybody's got incredibly busy lives with their own thing. Like everybody went on to be pretty successful with whatever they do. It's pretty phenomenal, actually, this band. You know, it's like everyone's crazy busy, families. Some people don't really like performing that much. So it's not a big like desire for them. So it just kind of doesn't appear to be in the cards, and we're all totally in good communication and friendly and hang out when we can, which is very rarely, but we do. So it's like nothing bad. It's just,
yeah. Well, so yeah. Adam and I, we went to Mosswood Meltdown this year and we recorded an episode, mm-hmm. and we were posing the question, why are there no ska bands at Mosswood, and what would be the perfect ska band to play Mosswood? And you know the conclusion that we came to?
No.
Dance Hall Crashers. That would be the perfect band to headline Mosswood Meltdown.
The headline. Ow, they're too garage rock. We're not cool enough.
I feel like Dance Hall would work.
I mean, I appreciate that you say that.
Now, I have no pull. I have no pull at Mosswood, so I'm not making an offer. I'm just willing it into existence.
I appreciate it. I really do appreciate it. I mean, yes, and we're East Bay, so mm-hmm. we should
exactly
represent, but I don't know. I don't know if we're like ever really cool enough. Like that's like all garage rock. It's like, you know, Shannon the Clams is like, she's yeah. amazing. And it's so many thrashy bands. And I say that in a positive, with a positive light. It's like all about, and we were just kind of more poppy and like bubblegum.
I would bet you $1,000 that Shannon the Clams, Shannon is a Dancehall Crashers fan.
I know her personally. I don't think she knows who the hell we are, but maybe.
Well, I'm still bet $1,000.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
She's fucking amazing. I love her. And I love her music. She's just great. And she's also just a lovely person. I love everything they do. Don't think she's a Dancehall Crashers fan. Although, you know, there are people that really do surprise me that are Dancehall Crashers fans. Just when I think like, oh, we're so bubblegum and people don't probably know or care about like the Descendants, those guys are like the biggest Dancehall fans and their kids go crazy for it. It's like so funny to me. You guys are like ultimate punk rockers to me. Like, but you know, Stefan and Bill, and they're like crazy Dancehall Crashers fans. So that kind of stuff always does surprise me, because I really do think that we kind of maybe don't appeal to those people. I don't know. But like John Waters, like, I don't know. I don't know. It's like Meltdown is like, you know, it's like the OCs and the, and Shannon and like all the, I mean, the B-52s did it. I see your point.
Yeah. Le Tigre did it 2 years ago.
Yeah. But Le Tigre is like, and Bikini Kill are way more like, I mean, I feel like a Riot Girl, but I think that those are like, they're just way more hardcore than we were.
I think you guys can pull it off. Plus you got the East Bay cred. Come on.
It's true. All right. I'll see if they offer us anything and then we'll go from there.
We're just trying to will it into existence.
Hopefully someone from Mosswood Meltdown is listening.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying Ska now more than ever.
Right. Thanks for joining us. If you want a little bit more, Carnes, why don't you tell them what they can do?
Well, there's this thing called the In Defense of Ska Patreon, and it's probably the greatest thing that has ever existed and probably the best investment you can ever make with your hard-earned cash.
Yeah. 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 We're all about giving you your financial planning advice at this point. And our advice to you is to invest that money into In Defense of Ska. Not only will it increase the quality of your life, but you'll be defending Ska along with all your other Ska defenders. Sign up now.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.